The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the fiction section of the June 26, 2023 issue of the New Yorker, Status in Flux, by Wiki Wang. For 2 years, no one traveled. Countries closed their borders to other countries that had closed their borders first. When borders reopened, everyone began traveling again, in full force. There would always be another variant. Best to see the world while you could. Around this time, I developed insomnia and began driving by myself at night. The first night, I drove to a 24-hour supermarket. I stood in front of the frozen food section, occasionally opening a freezer door to grab something and then changing my mind. It was not that in year three I couldn't travel, but to do so was ill-advised. My husband was an American citizen, and we lived in New Jersey. Renewing my work visa yet again seemed like a complete waste of everyone's time, so we'd hired a lawyer for my green card process, and in one of the six-minute phone slots we had with her, she told me to stay put during the period between the application submission and the interview. I could travel within the U.S., but leaving the country was tricky. My husband asked how long we would have to stay put. The lawyer said that the average case took at least 11 months now, since the prior administration had stalled many green cards, since the prior administration had wished to limit immigration from certain countries. I reminded the lawyer that I was Canadian, and she said that to leave the country and to try to come back was to risk being held up at customs for not having a clear residency status in either Canada or the U.S. Once we submit these forms, she said, your status will be in flux. The lawyer also emphasized that I absolutely could not quit my job during the application process. The company I worked for had already submitted proof of employment. If I quit, the company would rescind the form and my application would be far less strong. In addition to the forms, we had to provide photographs of ourselves and my work visas, our marriage license and birth certificates, notarized letters confirming that our marriage was genuine, and the sealed results of a medical exam showing that I was thoroughly vaccinated and not a carrier of any communicable diseases, such as tuberculosis, syphilis, or gonorrhea. Grad school was my sole reason for coming to this country, and had I not met my husband, I would not have stayed. Now it was as if, through him, I were trying to steal status or jump the line. On each form, we triple-checked dates, addresses, and the spellings of our names. One form was titled Petition for Alien Relative, another Application for Advanced Parole, parole allowing me to travel for absolute emergencies, which the lawyer said to avoid. So it wasn't just that I felt both alien and criminal. The words were plainly there. The lawyer mentioned possible complication that could lead to delays. Although I had Canadian citizenship, I was born in China. The green card would open my route to American citizenship, and I might end up a citizen of two countries, neither of which was my birthplace. In annoyed male voice, my husband asked why that would be a complication. In an annoyed female voice, our lawyer replied, "I don't make the rules, just anticipate delays." My husband never had insomnia. He slept soundly through the night, every night, and that made me want to kick him, like with both feet on his back, propelling him off the bed and onto the floor. Once I'd had that thought, I put on a jacket and got into the car. At the supermarket again, I decided on frozen pizzas. I bought 7, of varying crust thickness. I thought maybe as a fun activity, we could only eat pizza for a week, going from thin crust to deep dish. The boxes barely fit in our freezer, which meant that we had to go from deep dish to thin crust. When I handed my husband a 2-inch thick pepperoni slice the next morning, he told me to stop night driving. It was incredibly unsafe. "What if you get mugged in the parking lot?" he said. "What if a shooter comes in?" But I'd already thought of that possibility. If a shooter came to that specific supermarket at 1 a.m., I would launch myself over the deli counter and hide behind them. My parents still lived in Ontario, in the city of London, just north of Lake Erie, a two-hour drive from Detroit. When I told people where I was from, I made sure to say Ontario and not London, to avoid having them think that I meant the other London, where more people were from. When my parents and I were naturalized in Canada, a man in uniform took our Chinese passports and punched holes through them all along the bottom. I was not yet 18, and my parents instructed me on the benefits of naturalization. To work or travel or buy property as a Canadian citizen was infinitely easier than doing so as a Chinese one. And if I married a Canadian, I would not need him for citizenship. I would already have it. I was driving during the daytime like a normal person when my parents called from Buenos Aires prior to embarking on a 2,000-person cruise. Retired, they now used their savings to voyage the world and were finally off to see Antarctica before it melted down to a nub. "Vi," they said in unison for hello. "Vi, vi, vi," until I said "vi" back. Then they wanted to know what my lawyer had said and when we could all fly to China to visit my last living grandparent, a woman well into her 90s who had held on through several lockdowns, per my mother, in order to see me, my cousins, and my parents in the same room one last time, an event that had not occurred since I was a child. After I told them what the lawyer had said, they sighed in unison. Why I had chosen to stay in America after grad school was beyond them. Yes, the pay was better, but the health insurance was much worse. I said, "My job is here, my husband, friends, but..." "Did it ever occur to your husband?" asked my father, who only ever referred to my husband as your husband, never Matt, his official name. "Did it ever occur to your husband to move to Canada where, in 30 years, everyone will be moving because climate change will make so much of America uninhabitable?" I didn't have a response to that. "Hey," my father said after too much time had passed. My father was against the green card and, on principle, dual citizenship. Why did China not allow dual citizenship? Because that country knew what he knew. You're either in or you're out. There's no such thing as sharing first place. The fact that dual citizenship conferred the right to vote in two countries made him nervous. One person shouldn't get two votes when so many have none. My parents had no desire to move to the U.S. All they saw in the news were the crazy elections, the guns, and the perpetual droughts and floods in California, the only state they liked, for its gorgeous coastline. Jersey rarely had disasters like that, I explained. You didn't even have to pump your own gas. There was always a Wawa or a highway to take you out of Jersey to anywhere else you like. "Vee, vee?" my father asked, and I said, "No, Wawa." Matt had a sister, younger by 10 years. She was my Gen Z sister-in-law, who, when happy, snapped her fingers silently and said, "Slay." Soon after Europe reopened, she gave herself a 6-month sabbatical in Spain. By sabbatical, she meant that she had quit her job abruptly, and 6 months was the length of time she could afford to travel before she had to find another job. She wished to become fluent in Spanish while volunteer teaching English. My husband asked how she was going to get fluent in another language when she spent most of the time speaking the one she already knew. His sister asked why he had to be like that when she was already low-key stressed. Until the lawyer said that we shouldn't travel, the plan had been for us to visit her and for my husband to slip her a thick envelope of cash, metaphorically, through Venmo, which would then allow her more months in which to become fluent. I loved this about my husband, the big gestures, the soft heart. Naturalization was a big gesture, and once my green card application was in, my husband told his parents, and his parents drove across 2 states that day to take us out to lunch. At lunch, my mother-in-law had a glow and spoke of how pleased she was that I was coming into the family, though Matt and I had already been married for 2 years and had dated for 5 years before that. She asked if a green card was actually green, and I said that it was a muted, tasteful green, like sage, but formally it was called a Certificate of Alien Registration and was granted only to little green men with abnormally large heads. The joke landed badly, and my new family stared at me. "You're not a man," my mother-in-law huffed. "You're an accomplished young woman with a reasonably sized head." She added that, once the bureaucratic BS was over, she would like us all to go to Portugal, where she thought we had some lineage, having just got her results from Ancestry.com. I told my mother-in-law that I had no Portuguese ancestors, and she asked how I could be so sure. Had I done Ancestry.com? I didn't always go to the supermarket. Sometimes I sat in the car and scrolled through my phone. Obviously, I could have done that from bed, but night driving was not supposed to be rational, and I clicked on way more random links while I was in an empty, well-lit parking lot. 90% of Canadians live within 100 miles of the border, a fact I learned from a page of facts that you might not know about Canadians. The first time I typed the word naturalization in a text, my phone autocorrected it to neutralization. A good friend of mine had been planning her wedding, and then the pandemic happened, and it was postponed and postponed and postponed. Finally, she canceled the thing altogether and went to City Hall. The money she saved by not paying for half a wedding, deposits were lost, she put toward a honeymoon of indefinite length. She and her husband would go to Korea and Japan, across Southeast Asia, through Morocco and the nice parts of Europe, and then down to Patagonia. Korea for her relatives, who would not have flown out for her wedding anyway, Japan for his. To reduce her other commitments, she, like my sister-in-law, left her job, and he had already been laid off. The husband came from enough family wealth not to have needed the job he was laid off from in the first place. Nor, after the marriage, did she need to work. While they were in Korea, she started a social media account on which she posted a daily picture and captioned it with an itemized list of how much they'd spent that day on food, housing, and transportation. The goal was to stay frugal. On the one hand, it made sense. But on the other, why? While I was at my job that I couldn't quit, a photograph arrived in my inbox from my father. I saw two people of my parents' height and build, bundled in several layers of coats, with dark sunglasses and full face wraps, holding a sign indicating that they'd arrived in Antarctica. There was no way to confirm that these were my parents. I could not even tell if the individuals were Asian. A day later, he sent me another email, a photo of two certificates they'd received from the ship's captain, printed with their full Chinese names, confirming that they had transited the Antarctic Peninsula, going all the way to a latitude of 64 degrees, 58 minutes south. My father liked, as I did, tangible and quantifiable markers of success. As our lawyer kept saying, for my application to succeed, my marriage had to be bona fide. We heard that phrase on loop, sometimes twice in one billable minute. From the Latin meaning in good faith, genuine and not counterfeit, I imagine the ancients waving bits of gold at one another and saying, "This is a bona fide Roman coin. Now give me in return a bona fide donkey." One Sunday morning, while we were having breakfast, Matt's sister video called us and asked what we were doing. Before we had a chance to answer, she started to cry. She was outside on a roof deck, sipping midday a glass of Madeira. The sky looked beautiful, but we couldn't comment on it. We had to jump right in. Trouble with her host family. Trouble with the school. The family had set a curfew, which she had already broken twice. The third time she would have to go. The school had led her to believe that she would be more like a tutor paired with small groups. Some days, 30 kids showed up to her classroom, and each child wanted to be read to. But no two could agree on the same book. When parents complained at pickup, she couldn't follow enough of their Spanish. On top of that, her best guy friend from college was meant to visit this weekend, but had canceled at the last minute after having contracted the virus. Matt listened patiently, not pressing her about the curfew or the guy friend. I was about to say that the fastest way to learn a language is to be put in impossible situations where you are yelled at and you can't yell back. Trust me, I've been there, and trust me, you will survive. But seeing my sister-in-law cry on a roof deck made any teachable moment seem cruel. Why tell someone to just survive when she wants to thrive? She's having a bad time, my mother-in-law said on FaceTime a few days later from the airport at the gate for a flight to Spain. A very bad time, and she's all alone. She's just a child. But that doesn't mean you drop everything and go to her, Matt said. Absolutely it does, she said. Children are children. His mother worried about us, too, and asked Matt, not infrequently, what if the green card doesn't go through? The lawyer offered no guarantee, but believed that my case would not fail. Unless I lost my employer or husband or committed a felony or developed one of those communicable diseases or traveled out of the country or showed up drunk to the interview or gave answers that unbonafided us or made me seem unpatriotic. From Patagonia, my friend posted reel after reel of her and her husband spinning 360 degrees in lush valleys surrounded by snow-capped peaks. The wind here is constant, she wrote in her caption, allowing for a steady flow of hashtag puns about how the most beautiful place in the world was blowing them away. You have FOMO, my husband said. It's a 20-mile hike to get there, I said, not to mention the flight down the ferry, the bus to the campsite. In truth, I never really liked the logistics of travel. Jet lag often turned into insomnia. I puked in moving vehicles without warning. Once, on a wine tour in Tuscany, I took off my own sock to puke into it. The van didn't have bags. That sock I had to leave in the Tuscan countryside by a gravel road. As I was puking into it, I thought of my mother and an event that I had no memory of, but that she knew had happened, because she was there. On the plane from China to Canada are one-way tickets paid for by my grandparents so that my mother and I could reunite with my father in Ontario and start our fun immigrant lives. On this 13-hour flight, I drank an entire can of Sprite. I'd never been on a plane. I'd never been given an entire can of Sprite. I was small enough that when I stood on my seat, my head barely cleared the headrest. The person in the row behind waved to the top of my bowl cut. Then, my mother said, I stood on tiptoe and projectile vomited at this person the entire contents of the can. Was that act my secret rebellion against leaving China? Was it my body knowing that I would not see my grandparents and cousins again for at least 5 years? Was my projectile vomit FOMO? That's not what people mean by FOMO, my husband said. Fear of missing out on what you have left behind. FOMOOWYHLB, I said. My husband remained silent. My friend and her husband traveled to Santiago, and in a new post she was eating with a happy Asian couple who turned out to be my mom and dad. I texted my mother about their whereabouts, and she confirmed that they were indeed in Chile exploring the art. Art? I texted back. News to me that my mother cared about art. Yes, we love art, she replied. She and my father had bumped into my friend and her husband at a food court, to which, after visiting art museums that morning, they'd all gone with the same idea of getting a cheap meal from the equivalent of a Panda Express. My parents paid for the meal, which was why my friend wrote in her caption, so serendipitous meeting the parents of a friend, $0 for lunch, YOLO. What were the chances? I said to my husband. Matt looked at the photo of my friend, her husband, and my parents. He said, everyone there probably thinks the four of them are a family. The institution of family meant a lot to Matt. To look like a family, to have the same paperwork and last name, though I hadn't changed my name, and he and I did not look like a family. We don't all have to match, I used to tell him. We're not a suit of cards. But I also understood his desire for congruity. At border control, officers inspecting our passports ask him no questions and ask me the most obvious ones, like what my country of citizenship was and where I was born. These two answers never matched, and it seemed that the point of their questions was to remind me of that fact. Here was another reason I loved my husband. He had a very idealized sense of justice. Once, before we boarded a plane to the other London, a gate attendant called me to the desk, where she checked my ticket and passport, which had already been checked by TSA. Then I was escorted to stand in a line just outside the gate alongside other women, some with children, some without, but all of a darker skin tone than those who were being allowed to board. A second gate attendant checked my passport and, after holding the picture up to my face, let me go. My husband had been long ago cleared to board, but stood fuming at the desk, where the first attendant assured him that passport checks were random, and he replied, "Oh, really?" "I'm fine," I told him on the bridge, where he shouldered my carry-on, so that he was now holding three bags and pulling a roller board, and I was carrying nothing. Not far from the supermarket was a 24-hour gas station with 10 lanes. I opened my window a sliver and asked for the tank to be filled, and then the windshield cleaned. Not far from the 24-hour gas station were a school, a park, and a 24-hour cemetery. As I looped around the cemetery, I thought about death and rebirth. Immigration is both of these things. And there was a period in middle school when all my mother and I did on weekends was to go to the mall and sit at the food court, a plate of stir-fried noodles between us. She didn't care about art then. We had no money for cruises or things we didn't need. The eating of those noodles was either death by salt or dismay at what the West had done to Chinese food. "I really hate it here," my mother would tell me. "I wish I could leave." The implication being that my existence prevented her from leaving, which prevented her from being happy, and had I not been physically in front of her, she might have just given up on the process and left me, the mall, and the country without being reborn. By default, zombies have insomnia. In Zombia, to be undead, you first have to die and then claw yourself out of your own grave. A pale hand sprouts from the dirt like a spring daffodil. "I be alive," this zombie shouts. Then she wanders around in confusion for years. "Can someone help me with a problem? Can someone please tell me if I'm dead or alive?" For a week, I slept and felt like a real person, as opposed to, say, a zombie. During this great week of clarity, I told myself, yes, I'm excited to be 1 degree closer to being American, excited when 3 years after I get the green card I can apply for citizenship, to become Chinese-Canadian-American, like one of those people with multiple last names. Clarity led to productivity, and during this great week of productivity, I compiled marriage interview tips and sample questions. Tip: do not give vague or inconsistent answers. Question: what color is your current bedroom duvet? Tip: but no need to avoid talking about difficulties you've had as a couple. Question: how many duvet covers do you have and who buys them? When we practiced, Matt guessed 2 and I said 6 because I'd bought them, and staring at me, he exclaimed, "6? Further details, should the U.S. government be interested. The 6 duvet covers are of different textiles, and this alien is unable to sleep under any of them. Aliens can experience identity fractures or short circuits of the brain. Eventually, new bone grows over these fractures, healthy cells wrapping existential ones. Zombies are not bona fide people, but they're closer to being people than aliens, so... The next time Matt's sister video called us, she was on a different roof deck. She looked happy, tanned. She had done something new with her hair. "Surprise," she said, and panned the phone to my mother-in-law, who we knew was there, and my father-in-law, who we did not. Matt turned his phone to face himself completely. "Dad, what the F are you doing there?" he said. Matt and his father had the usual bond: baseball, barbecues, inside jokes. Dad would have told me if he was going to Spain, Matt must have thought, and what did it mean that he hadn't? "Hey, son," his father said, and took Matt's sister's phone and put it to his ear. For a few seconds, until Matt's sister convinced him that he could hold the screen at arm's length and talk directly at it, we saw only the dark inside of my father-in-law's auditory canal. "Just here for the weekend," his father said, holding the phone exactly at arm's length. "Didn't want to make a fuss in case you guys felt left out." My mother-in-law could be heard saying her husband's name sternly. My father-in-law looked off-screen and said, "What?" Soon, sister, mother, and father all had to go. A sunset dinner, dance party, river cruise. and more Madeira. Later, I asked Matt if he wanted to talk about it, and he said what was there to talk about? Our two families abroad, having fun without us. What was the big deal about that? He busied himself with emails, one in particular, politely worded but long, asking our lawyer when we could expect to have news. Not that we didn't understand the process or were trying to rush it, not that we wished to piss off the U.S. government or her. Both she and the government had important jobs, freedom, etc. Waiting for a green card was a first-world problem, and while the mention of first-world problems has never made a person living in the first world feel better, we were grateful to have these problems over others. Thanks so much for the opportunity. Beyond manifest anxiety, it was unclear what the email was actually about. He got a reply immediately, an out-of-office message informing us that the lawyer was on holiday. When my insomnia came back, I drove to the usual places. For three nights straight, I had my full tank topped off. The fourth night, I wondered what lay beyond the cemetery, so I drove a little further. Beyond the cemetery was another supermarket, another Wawa, another highway that took me to another gas station, then suburbs, churches, schools, more cemeteries. As I drove, I wondered how many iterations of American towns I'd have to pass through to get to the Canadian border. North was the border. East was the ocean. For each minute I drove, I asked myself what would happen if I drove for another minute. It's only another minute, I thought. And when was the last time I'd gone to the border? What did a border look like these days? And supermarket or cemetery? With which would this country end? Next, from the book section of the June 26, 2023 issue, How a Frenchman Stole $2 Billion Worth of Art. His crime spree makes for a thrilling read, but why do heist stories steal our hearts anyway? By Catherine Schultz. The first thing Stefan Breitweiser steals from Belgium's Art and History Museum is an index card. Folded in half and set inside a partially empty display case, it reads, in French, "Object removed for study." The museum contains one of the largest collections of art and antiquities in Europe, but Breitweiser immediately recognizes that, for his purposes, its most valuable item is the note card. He jimmies open the case, pockets the card, and together with his girlfriend and accomplice, Anne Catherine Kleinkaus, strolls onward. To anyone who happens to notice them, they look like a happy, art-loving young couple enjoying a date at a museum, which, in a sense, they are. A few rooms later, another display case catches Breitweiser's eye. This one is filled with fantastically ornate 16th century silver objects, including goblets, chalices, and a miniature warship. The lock, he notices, is high-end but poorly installed. He smacks the top, and the cylinder drops out of its housing and into the display case. Breitweiser helps himself to two chalices and a tankard, then sets the index card down where they used to be. Only when he and Klinkhaus have reached his card does he realize that he has left the lid of the tankard behind. That won't do. He is an aesthetic perfectionist. A topless tankard will be a torment to him. Klinkhaus knows this about her boyfriend, and although he is usually the improvisational genius, she can hold her own when circumstances require it. She takes out one of her earrings and returns to the entrance, Breitweiser in tow. When she shows the guard her remaining earring and says she thinks she knows where she lost the other one, he lets them both back inside. At the display caser, Breitweiser takes the tankard lid along with, why not, two additional goblets. They return 2 weeks later. The index card is still in the case. So is the warship, which Breitweiser puts in Kleinkaus's purse. Then, from the same display, he nicks a two-foot-tall chalice, which he stuffs up the sleeve of his coat, making it impossible to bend his left arm. The pair are on their way to the exit when a guard asks to see their tickets. Kleinkaus's is at the bottom of her purse, beneath the ship. Breitweiser's is in his left pocket, which he can't access with his left hand. He reaches across his body, like a man drawing a sword, fishes out the ticket, hands it to the guard, and explains that they're just headed to the museum cafe to grab a bite to eat. The guard waves them on, and they go to the cafe, sit down with their ill-gotten goods, and have lunch. 2 days later, they come back for more, bringing the total number of artifacts they have stolen from that single display to 11. Aside from the objects removed for study card, the case is now almost empty. On their way out of town, they stop at an antique shop whose front window boasts a beautiful 17th century silver and gold urn. Later, back home, Klein Klaus phones the shop and asks how much the urn cost. "Around $100,000, the owner tells her, "but it's worth it." "Madame," he says, "you really must see it." But, of course, by then, the urn is no longer in his window. It is in a modest house in an industrial town in eastern France, in the attic rooms occupied by Breitweiser, Klein Klaus, and some $2 billion worth of stolen art. All this is recounted, thrillingly, in The Art Thief, published by Knopf, by the journalist Michael Finkel. It is his third book, and also the third one to search for meaning, moral, aesthetic, existential, and criminal acts. This is an interest he comes by honestly, or more precisely, dishonestly. In 2002, Finkel, who was then a contributing writer at the New York Times magazine, plummeted from grace when the protagonist of an article he wrote about allegations of child slavery on West African cocoa plantations turned out to be a composite character. The Times fired him and soon afterward published a lengthy correction which took his transgressions from private to public and took a sledgehammer to his reputation. An hour and a half before that correction ran, Finkel got a phone call from a fellow reporter. To his surprise, confusion, relief, and horror, the man was not calling about his journalistic offenses. He was calling to ask if Finkel was aware that someone named Christian Longo, who was accused of and would later confess to murdering his wife and three young children in Oregon, had recently been captured in Mexico, where he had adopted the identity of a writer he admired, Michael Finkel of the Times magazine. Real and faux Finkel began to correspond, and both men's misdeeds became fodder for the writer's first book, True Story, Murder, Memoir, Mea Culpa. A dozen years later, Finkel published The Stranger in the Woods, an account of a man named Christopher Knight who, for 27 years, lived in the forest of central Maine, entirely outdoors and alone, getting by on the haul from a decades-long burglary streak that kept him in both necessities and luxuries, food, clothing, batteries, propane tanks, sleeping bags, mattresses, books, television sets, handheld games. Now comes The Art Thief, which documents a different kind of crime, one that circumvents both the moral horror of murder and the mundanity of petty theft. From 1994 to 2001, Breitweiser, working mostly with Klein Klaus, but sometimes alone, stole at a pace unprecedented in the history of art, roughly 3 out of 4 weekends per year for 8 years, resulting in some 300 purloined works of art. He plied his craft during business hours, in museums and galleries and auction houses, with tourists and docents and security guards milling around. He never wore a mask and rarely disguised himself at all. He carried no weapons, never hurt anyone, and never threatened to hold anyone hostage. He did not use the art he stole to fund other illegal activities or sustain an extravagant lifestyle. He simply took it home to those attic rooms and admired it. As illegal activities go, the crime spree of Stefan Breitweiser was decorous, electrifying, and, for all its outrageousness, familiar. As a form of entertainment, The Art Thief has less in common with Finkel's earlier books than with movies such as Ocean 11. Like that film, it unmistakably belongs to the genre of the heist, a category of entertainment so fun and frictionless that it is easy to skate right past the obvious question it raises. Why, given our overall disapproval of theft, are stories about heists so appealing to so many of us, and specifically to Michael Finkel. A heist, to be clear, is not a legal category. If you are caught with a Rembrandt in your raincoat on the way out of the Louvre, you will not be charged with attempted heist. The term is pure slang. Coined in America in the 1920s, a high water decade for crimes of all kinds. It likely comes from hoist, either in the sense of hoisting someone up to shimmy through a window, or in that other sense of picking something up, the one implied by shoplifting. But no one has ever described the pilfering of a can of Red Bull and a pack of condoms as a heist. Indeed, real-life crimes are only infrequently characterized that way. For the most part, heist suggests less a specific legal illegal action than the form of entertainment that depicts it. Although the heist genre shares a border with mystery novels, spy novels, true crime, and crime fiction, it has its own distinctive convention, the first of which is that the object of the theft must be spectacularly valuable. Steal $30,000 or a Rolex watch, and it's a crime. Steal $30 million or the Hope Diamond, and it's a heist. Second, that object must be taken from an institution of significant standing. Heists do not occur at Sunoco stations or suburban homes. They happen in banks, preferably on Wall Street, or museums, preferably the Met. Third, the theft must be borderline impossible. That's why every heist plot pauses at some point to explain why, for instance, the thieves have to rob not one casino, but three at the same time, as in Steven Soderbergh's 2001 remake of the aforementioned Ocean's 11, among the most genre-satisfying of all heist films. Or why they have to steal not one car, but 50 in less than 3 days, as in the 2000 remake of Gone in 60 Seconds, which features Nicolas Cage and Angelina Jolie in what you might call a car-studded cast, among others an Aston Martin, a Ferrari Testarossa, a Lamborghini Diablo, a Bentley Arnage, and a 1967 Ford Mustang Shelby GT500. Give or take some paraphrasing, in almost every heist story, someone says, "It can't be done." But it can, of course. You just need the right criminals. That's the fourth convention of the heist, assembling a team. Its members are typically underworld all-stars, each one the master of a highly specialized skill, picking pockets, counting cards, hacking computers, back-flipping over in motion detectors, strolling into Sotheby's with so much savoir-faire as to seem like a legitimate customer. Collectively, they illustrate the point, made by, of all people, Aristotle, that just as there are outstanding doctors and musicians, there are also perfect thieves, who have no deficiency in respect of the form of their peculiar excellence. According to a fifth convention, however, when we first encounter these perfect thieves, they are wasting their talents on petty chicanery or attempts at moral rectitude. A sixth convention is that at least one of them has retired and must be dragged back into a life of crime for one last irresistible gig. In a nice meta move, Soderbergh came out of retirement to direct Logan Lucky, essentially an Appalachian Ocean's 11 in which the West Virginian protagonist set out to rob a NASCAR speedway. Perhaps the most crucial convention of the heist story, however, is that despite possessing so many illicit aptitudes, the thieves must barely seem like criminals. Often they reassure us that they steal for pleasure rather than for profit, delighting either in the work itself or in the specific item they are stealing. "I didn't do it for the money," Cage's character declares in Gone in 60 Seconds. "I did it for the cars." When the thieves are motivated by profit, their victims are presented as so wealthy and corrupt that they deserve to be robbed. Per the logic of Robin Hood, it's appropriate to steal from the rich as long as you redistribute the bounty to the poor. Per the logic of the heist, it's appropriate to steal from the rich because they are rich. The implication, a comfortable one in today's 1% world, is that anyone affluent enough to own so much desirable stuff didn't come by it honestly either. In short, in a heist story, the bad guys are basically the good guys. At worst, they are cheerfully and debonairly amoral, as in Ocean's 8, the all-female entry in the franchise, whose plot involves an ethically indefensible but nonetheless enjoyable theft at the Met Gala of a whole lot of bling. At best, they are righting some grievous wrong, as in Inside Man, where the target of the heist is a Nazi collaborator. Much of the time, though, they are either robbing other criminals, as in The Italian Job, for whom one can have only so much sympathy, or simply getting their due, as in Logan Lucky, where the heisters retain just enough for their haul to leave behind their hardscrabble lives. In keeping with this ethic of ethicalness, many heists are bloodless, or largely so. If they deal out violence or death at all, it is only to the truly wicked. Not all of these conventions appear in every heist story, of course, but taken together they define an identifiable category while allowing for endless riffing. Wes Anderson's 2009 animated film Fantastic Mr. Fox is a heist narrative, as is the 2008 documentary Man on Wire about Philippe Petit's illegal tightrope walk between the Twin Towers, a planning-filled, panache-filled, victimless crime at a major institution. Heists of all kinds also appear in books of all kinds, in fiction that ranges from the potboilerish Gerald A. Brown's 11 Harrow House to the ambitious Colson Whitehead's Harlem Shuffle, and in nonfiction that details the theft of valuable goods from the obvious to the absurd. Gold, diamonds, pearls, cash, rare books, rare maps, rare feathers, rocks from the moon. Of all the priceless objects in the world, however, perhaps none lend themselves so well to the heist narrative as works of art. That's not just because art is expensive, housed in grand institutions, and difficult to steal. It is also because anyone motivated to steal art, for art's sake, as the convention dictates, seems intrinsically refined, the kind of genteel thief whose moral lapses are overshadowed by excellent taste. This idealized criminal reached its fictional apotheosis in the 1999 version of The Thomas Crown Affair, another remake, like many good heist movies, which starts Pierce Brosnan as an art thief so charming and cultivated that the insurance investigator tasked with trying to catch him falls in love with him instead. But as the actual people responsible for catching art thieves understand, Thomas Crown is not merely fictional, but also fantastical. A thief like him, daring and skilled, but also motivated by aesthetics and deeply knowledgeable about art, is a figment of our collective imagination. So virtually every police officer, detective, and museum security expert would have told you until Stefan Breitweiser came along. How does a highly improbable person come to exist? The backstory Finkel tells us is this. Breitweiser was a troubled and solitary young man who, via the divorce of his parents, fell from the upper classes, a life of boating on Lake Geneva and skiing in the Alps, to a considerably lower rung of society. For him, the symbol of that fall and its essential injustice was that he went from enjoying a home filled with high art and antique weaponry to living with his mother in an apartment decorated with cheap movie posters and, horror of horrors, IKEA furniture. After graduating from high school, he flitted from job to job, beginning with a brief stint as a museum guard, the last day of which he celebrated by stealing a 1,500-year-old Merovingian belt buckle. Eventually, he met and fell in love with Anne Catherine Kleinklaus, a nurse's aide with good taste and a calm demeanor, who later moved in with him in the attic rooms of his mother's new home, small but an upgrade from the apartment. The couple enjoyed visiting museums together, and one day, at a little one in an Alsatian village, they admired a flintlock pistol whose chief virtue, from Breitweiser's perspective, was that it was nicer than any his father owned. She urged him to take the pistol, and he did. They got away with it and got a taste for it. Unlike most art thieves, but very much like a classic heist hero, Breitweiser steals art because he loves it. He spends his free time reading histories of art, biographies of artists, and catalogues raison And he tells Finkel that beautiful objects should be liberated from the prison of museums so that they can be experienced appropriately, at length, up close, in the privacy of his bedroom. Almost any of the works he steals could net him a small fortune, and plenty of them, a Bruegel, a Watteau, a Lucas Cranach the Elder, are worth a large one, yet he refuses to sell any. Instead, he lives off his mother's patience, his girlfriend's meager salary, and intermittent low-wage jobs, leaving him so short on money that Finkel writes, quote, even on getaway drives, he avoids paying highway tolls, end quote. But then, Breitweiser isn't big on getaway drives in the first place. Like the classic heist hero, he disapproves of haste, violence, and drama of all kinds. The best theft, to his mind, is not so much stylish as invisible. In one crucial respect, however, Breitweiser is nothing like Thomas Crown. Most heist narratives feature plans so elaborate that they constitute much of the plot. But Breitweiser generally undertakes his thefts with no real forethought. He simply spots something that he likes in a museum or sometimes in a museum brochure or an auction catalog. Either way, only once he is standing in front of the object of his desire does he devise a strategy for stealing it. Part of what makes Finkel's book so much fun is that, without exception, those strategies are insane. To be specific, some are insanely risky. When Breitweiser realizes that a crossbow he covets is hanging by a wire from the ceiling, too high to reach, he drags a chair the length of the weapons hall, climbs on top, and unhitches the bow from the wire. Others are insanely simple. When a security camera turns out to be aimed at the work he wants to steal, he just keeps his back to the lens throughout the theft. Others are insanely spontaneous. When he and Klein Klaus are attending the European Fine Art Fair, a venue full of both undercover and uniformed security, a more foolhardy thief attempts to steal something and is promptly apprehended. Without any premeditation, Breitweiser takes advantage of the moment, the melee, the rubbernecking, the guards all flocking to the scene, to nick an extremely valuable Renaissance painting. How does he pull off such thefts again and again? With shocking minimalism. There is no rappelling from roofs, no triggering of fire alarms, no high-tech devices to shut down security systems. His gear consists chiefly of a Swiss Army knife and, weather permitting, an overcoat. Klein Klaus stands lookout, giving him a nod when all is clear and coughing when trouble is coming. He uses the knife to slice open the silicone seal on display cases, unscrew artwork from its base, in one instance, extracting 30 screws in a single visit, one patient turn at a time, and pry off the nails holding paintings in their frames, never to cut the canvas itself, an act he regards with abhorrence. Then, with precise timing, fleetness of motion, and the courage of his convictions, he picks up the object, stashes it in Klein Klaus's bag or on his person, and unhurriedly makes his way to the exit. All this suggests you don't know a lot from The Art Thief about the limitations of museum security. One is built into the nature of the institution. Unlike banks, museums must keep their valuables where the public can see them. Moreover, they must minimize the barriers between the viewer and the work. It would be difficult to steal a painting that had iron bars in front of it, like the windows of a ground floor Manhattan apartment, but it would also be difficult to enjoy it. Another problem is that the security systems are expensive, and most museums, especially smaller local ones, are reluctant to allocate money to upgrade them. As a result, many museums have far fewer effective safeguards than you might imagine. For these reasons, museum security relies heavily on the intuition and attentiveness of employees who, like all of us, can be distracted, beguiled, or bamboozled. In one episode, when Breitweiser and Klein Klaus decide to take a brief break from stealing, they join a museum tour, which they would ordinarily never do, since it means that at least one staff member could identify them. Midway through, Breitweiser has a revelation. Something that a thief would obviously never do is precisely what a thief should consider doing. He pulls off a theft mid-tour and then does it again and again during other tours in other places. Generalizing from the same principle, he and Kleinklaus start exchanging pleasantries with guards, asking them directions and waving goodbye when they leave with millions of dollars worth of art tucked into their bags and clothing. Even more brashly, Breitweiser likewise plays against type when dealing with law enforcement. After one theft, when he discovers that someone had keyed his car, he himself phones the police, who inspect the vehicle while stolen art sits in the trunk. On another occasion, he leaves a museum to find a cop in the process of issuing him a parking ticket. Cheap as ever, he hadn't fed the meter, and protests vociferously while carrying 6 square feet of plundered altarpiece panels in his jacket. Perhaps the most shocking thing about Breitweiser's methods, however, is not their simplicity or their brazenness, but their efficacy. In the 300 years that public museums have existed, Finkel tells us, very few individuals or gangs have pulled off a dozen or more heists. Breitweiser pulls one off every dozen days. He has been known to steal twice in a single weekend and to steal from 3 different museums in the same day. When a French art detective finally notices a pattern and compiles a list of 14 separate incidents he thinks could be related, he concludes that if a lone outfit is responsible for even half of them, it is astoundingly active. A Swiss inspector who also picks up the trail suspects that a single thief might have stolen between 10 and 20 paintings from European museums. At the time, 69 such paintings are adorning Breitweiser's attic walls. This ultra-lucrative, odds-defying crime streak is wonderfully narrated by Finkel in a tale whose trajectory is less rise and fall than crazy and crazier. Only briefly does his book lag in its discussions of the alleged science of our attraction to art, which, in addition to partaking uncritically of the mania for explaining all of human experience by waving in the general direction of evolution and MRIs, is top to bottom wrong. Darwin's theory of natural selection does not state that our species survives only by eliminating inefficiency and waste. Art does not exist because we've won the evolutionary war, and beauty is not in the medial orbital frontal cortex of the beholder. Even when the science is plausible, it flattens rather than sharpens Finkel's tale. Maybe there really are neurochemical imbalances capable of creating an unstoppable and sometimes criminal collector. But more likely, such an imbalance is one of many factors implicated in obsessive collecting, or cannot be clearly established as a cause rather than as a corollary or an effect of underlying issues. In any case, it is hardly a satisfying explanation for a figure as fascinating as Breitweiser. Of the who, what, when, where, and why of crime, it is always the last question that is hardest to answer. Better to acknowledge the depth of the mystery than wave it away with flimsy science. But that's just a quibble. Overall, The Art Thief, is like its title character, has confidence, elan, and great sense of timing. It is propelled by suspense and surprises, and it is neither ashamed of nor stingy with the fundamental emotional payoffs of the heist. The disbelieving, no way, the unabashed glee at the deft accomplishment of the seemingly impossible and definitely illegal. Nor does it hesitate when the time comes to bring down the boom. In the final chapter of Finkel's book, his dashing young anti-hero turns old and sad. His relationship with Kleinklaus falls apart, even as she and Breitweiser's mother emerge as perhaps the most fascinating characters in the book, and arguably the most morally compromised. The claim that he takes scrupulous care of his art falls apart. The claim that he never sells anything he steals falls apart. The claim that he is not just a glorified shoplifter falls apart. In short, his whole life falls apart, and the book takes a hard, appropriate turn toward disgust and sorrow. Finkel, who has been to his own rock bottom, is both clear-eyed and compassionate about the downfall. But something more than sympathy lingers in his tone. It is kind of a wistful admiration, a yearning, even at the bitter end, to believe that an art thief is more than just another thief, a heist more than just another crime. The epigraph to The Art Thief is a maxim of Oscar Wilde's "Aesthetics are higher than ethics." This was an incendiary idea in its time, and for that matter remains a provocation in today's morally anxious literary culture. But what Wilde meant by it is a far cry from what Finkel implies by using it in his book. Wilde believed that, contrary to the claims of sentimentalism and of generations of prudish literary critics, the quality of a work of art does not depend on its ethical purity. That art depicting the degraded, the depraved, or the wicked can still be beautiful. Finkel, by contrast, suggests that aesthetics are higher than ethics, not when it comes to assessing artistic merit, but in the world at large, that beauty trumps morality no matter the context. The questions at the heart of all this is, to whom do the rules apply, and how much should we forgive someone for their crimes because their life is exceptional? Finkel's interest in such questions is self-evident, and The Art Thief has the feel of a book whose author has finally found his ideal subject. In the genre of the heist, where elegance really does trump ethics, we are called upon to admire people we should not, and Finkel is gifted at making us do so, presumably because to him that kind of admiration comes naturally. The clearest tale comes at the end of The Art Thief in the note on the reporting that details his research and sourcing. That note, which simultaneously serves to acknowledge his past misdeeds and to attempt to quiet any ongoing concerns, includes a story that does not appear elsewhere in the text. He and his subject are driving to the scene of one of Breitweiser's crimes at the home of the painter Peter Paul Rubens, now a museum, and on the way they stop at a busy rest area. In lieu of paying 70 cents to use the bathroom, Breitweiser ducks under the turnstile so swiftly and gracefully that no one but Finkel notices. Then he turns to the author and gestures at him to follow suit. Finkel declines. Invited to act without considering the consequences, to flout the rules in plain sight, to join the fellowship of first-class miscreants, Finkel responds in a way as revealing as anything in his many mea culpas. I wanted to. We've ran out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.